This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, September 9th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, across the globe, activists and world leaders push for non-military action in Syria. In new details about the U.S. government's massive spying program, the NSA can hack into smartphones, getting access to vast amounts of personal data. And Verizon challenges the FCC's open internet rule in a federal appeals court, a move that public interest groups say threatens free speech and online competition. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in headlines. Afghan officials say 9 civilians, most of them women and children, died in a NATO airstrike Saturday in Kunar province in the border region near Pakistan. There are conflicting reports as to whether or not the aircraft that launched the strike was a drone. Provincial Police Chief Abdul Habib Syed Kahili said the dead were passengers in a pickup truck that was boarded by men believed to be militants. NATO confirmed the strike, but claimed that 10 people died and said they had no information about civilians among them. President Hamid Karzai condemned the attack, saying in a statement that attacking women and children is against all accepted international norms. Pakistan inaugurated President Mamnoon Hussein today. The former governor and businessman from Karachi took over the largely ceremonial post from former President Asif Ali Zardari. It's the first peaceful democratic power handoff in Pakistan's history. Religious violence continued in central India today, and 3 more people were killed. The tension escalated after a young woman was sexually assaulted in what is locally referred to as eve teasing. Prabhakar Manitawari explains.
India has sent thousands of forces to the Muzaffarnagar district of Uttar Pradesh, where sectarian violence killed 3 more people today. Over the weekend, dozens died in clashes between Hindus and Muslims. The unrest began 2 weeks ago when the brothers of a Hindu woman killed the Muslim man their sister said had been sexually abusing her. His family retaliated, killing the brothers. The violence has now spread to neighboring districts. Curfew and shoot-at-sight orders are in force. Political leaders are barred from entering the area, and Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has placed more troops if necessary. The unrest has become political. The state's ex-chief minister Mayawati says the current government is not doing enough to prevent such violence.
Uttar Pradesh mein जब से समाजवादी पार्टी की सरकार बनी है तो तब से लेकर अभी तक यहाँ हर स्तर पर कानून व्यवस्था काफी ज्यादा बिगड़ी है.
उत्तर प्रदेश हैज हैड मोर कम्युनल वायलेंस इन द लास्ट 3 इयर्स देन एनी अदर इंडियन स्टेट एंड मेनी एट्रीब्यूट द अपटिक टू फोर्थकमिंग इलेक्शंस इन 2014. प्रभाकर मणि तिवारी, FSRN, कोलकाता.
In related news, so-called eve teasing or sexual harassment and assault that stops short of rape is widespread in India. Zee News reports today that when a young girl resisted such sexual abuse in the Sambal district of Uttar Pradesh, the 3 men who were harassing her allegedly set her on fire. And last week, a woman died in Mumbai after setting herself on fire following weeks of similar abuse by a neighbor. Congress returned to Washington today and immediately took up the possible use of military force against Syria. But despite paying federal taxes and often having served in the military, D.C. residents are not represented in the debate. The District of Columbia's non-voting delegate, Eleanor Holmes Norton, called today for D.C. to be included in a congressional vote. Noel Gallos has more.
Standing in front of the D.C. War Memorial, D.C. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton joined local officials and D.C. veterans today to remind President Obama that as he seeks congressional approval for the use of military force in Syria, he should remember the D.C. women and men who served in the military but don't have representation in Congress.
For us, the slogan of the Revolutionary War now has perverse meaning. Give your country your money and prepare to give your life, but do not expect to have a say on either.
Norton added that with the evidence that she's seen thus far, she'd vote no.
I haven't heard any more of the intelligence, and perhaps there's something I don't know, but I certainly am not convinced by what I've heard.
Many members of Congress, including those who voted for intervention in Iraq and Afghanistan, are bringing back anti-war messages from their constituents. Politico reports that of the 83 Republicans still in Congress who voted to give George W. Bush authorization to invade Iraq, only 10 have come out in support of military action in Syria. Noel Gallos, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
In Colorado, protesters plan to greet former President George W. Bush tonight when he's presented with a Global Service Award at the University of Denver. FSRN's Hannah Lee Myers reports.
Protesters plan to rally this evening in Denver, just before the University of Denver presents former President George W. Bush an award for global service. The Joseph Corbell School of International Studies originally planned to give Bush Jr. an award for improving the human condition. But more than 1,600 people signed an online petition. Two-thirds of the faculty signed a letter to the dean, and the school received hundreds of calls from students and alumni in protest. In response, the school changed the name of the honor to a Global Service Award. Many are not satisfied, including Alan Gilbert, one of the school's international studies professors.
It's a matter of his having committed war crimes and being an unrepentant war criminal. He violated international laws on torture and made the United States a torture state. He made that the symbol of American power.
Corbell's dean, Christopher Hill, was the U.S. ambassador to Iraq during the Bush administration and says tonight's event will include frank conversation that should be valuable to Corbell affiliates and the public. Hannah Lee Myers, FSRN, Boulder.
For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. International leaders gathered in Geneva today for the latest session of the United Nations Human Rights Council. The 47-member council will examine a number of issues during more than 2 weeks of meetings, including gender integration, indigenous peoples' human rights, and the rights of children whose parents have been executed by a government or who are on death row. United Nations Human Rights Chief Navi Pillay highlighted a number of areas of concern, including human rights violations in Bahrain and the occupied Palestinian territories, as well as the large number of bombings targeting civilians in Iraq. As the meetings get underway, Syria is a primary topic. In her opening statement, Pillay said when she addressed the council 2 years ago, the death toll was about 2,600 people.
Today, the number of dead stands at over 100,000. Last week, the number of refugees reached 2 million, and an additional 4 million people are displaced inside Syria. Camps in neighboring lands are struggling to cope, and we are just a few months away from winter. The suffering of Syria's civilian population has reached unimaginable levels.
Pillay said the international community has failed to take serious joint action to stop the downward spiral that has created one of the globe's worst humanitarian crises. But she warned about the consequences of Western military strikes in response to last month's chemical weapons attack.
There is no time for powerful states to continue to disagree on the way forward, or for geopolitical interests to override the legal and moral obligation to save lives by bringing this conflict to an end. This appalling situation cries out for international action, yet a military response or the continued supply of arms risk igniting a regional conflagration, possibly resulting in many more deaths and even more widespread misery. There are no easy exits, no obvious pathway out of this nightmare except the immediate negotiation of concrete steps to end the conflict.
Pillay, along with UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and a growing number of countries and groups, are pushing for a non-military response. Iran's Sayed Mohammad Reza Sajjadi addressed the council today on behalf of the Non-Aligned Movement, or NAM. He said they condemn all acts of violence in Syria committed by all parties, including the use of chemical weapons. He urged a diplomatic solution to end the bloodshed.
We concur with the High Commissioner that the military actions risk igniting a regional conflagration, resulting in many more deaths and even more widespread misery. We continue to believe that and that the only way out of this situation is the immediate negotiation to end the conflict.
Chile's delegation also urged a nonviolent response, including international support for the chemical weapons investigation and holding the perpetrators responsible. José Luis Balmaceda Cerig speaking through an interpreter.
As Pope Francis said, one cannot defend the people by killing the people. And along those lines, Chile would like to stress, as has been said in other international fora, that the Security Council has a irreplaceable role to play, particularly when it comes to any measure that will involve the use of force in the international system. Also, we need to seek an inclusive political solution which will represent all sectors of Syrian society. In order to achieve this, arms must fall silent, and the global community must be in a position to provide a peaceful alternative which will bring peace and security back to these people.
For the second weekend in a row, anti-war activists took to the streets to voice opposition to a military strike in Syria. Demonstrations took place in Washington, D.C., Seattle, Boston, Minneapolis, Chicago, Houston, New York, and other American cities on Saturday. Tens of thousands prayed for peace at the Vatican. U.S.-based protesters are calling on elected officials in Congress to reject a measure to use military force against Syria, which is moving quickly to a vote. In San Francisco, some 400 people rallied in 90-degree heat at the site activists renamed Chelsea Manning Plaza. FSRN's Judith Scher has the story.
U.S. NATO!
Hands off Syria!
U.S. NATO!
Hands off Syria!
At the waterfront rally, protesters displayed signs with messages such as "War on Syria, built on a lie," and "Bombing to stop killing, no." Speaking to the crowd, Gary Condon from Veterans for Peace had a message for the president he said was in the name of thousands of veterans.
President Obama, fool us once, shame on you, but we won't be fooled again.
Okay.
We remember Korea,
yeah.
We remember Vietnam, we remember El Salvador and Nicaragua, Panama, Grenada, we remember Afghanistan. We remember Iraq. This war has nothing to do with upholding international law. It has nothing at all to do with weapons of mass destruction.
Condon criticized Obama's assertion that American military personnel will not be placed in harm's way.
Because we have thousands of American troops, sailors that are sitting off the coast of Syria right now like sitting ducks, advertising to the world that they're about to launch an illegal unilateral attack on Syria. Our message to those soldiers, those sailors sitting on those ships outside of Syria, is you don't have to be part of this illegal war. You can refuse to participate, just like many have in the past, and we will support you if you do.
Protesters condemned Obama for planning to take the country into an action where both troops and civilians could be killed. Ruth McGuire is with Grandmothers for Peace.
It is so outrageous that we don't start talking instead of killing our young people, their young people, general populations. I don't understand how we could possibly help Syria by bombing them.
Many speakers and participants at the rally, organized by the Act Now to Stop War and Racism Coalition, noted that militarism depletes resources needed at home. Alan Fisher, an instructor at San Francisco City College, came with an American Federation of Teachers banner.
Instead of bombing Syria, we should use that money to take care of people, health care, education, jobs, and humanitarian assistance to Syrian refugees.
Activists said they had hoped to see thousands in the streets of San Francisco. Melvin Dixon, a former Black Panther and chair of the Black Panther Commemoration Committee, attributed the small turnout in part, to what he said was media propaganda.
The media is controlled by the same 1% that profits from this war, from wars of aggression. So we don't. The media going to do everything they can to misrepresent what the truth is about.
Despite the small numbers in the streets on Saturday, a recent Pew Research Center poll found that just 29% of Americans favor a strike against Syria. Activists have more rallies in the works. On Monday, MoveOn.org is sponsoring anti-war vigils across the country in advance of President Obama's address to the nation Tuesday night. And other actions are planned throughout the week. Judith Scher, FSRN, San Francisco.
In the latest revelations about U.S. government spying, the NSA has the capacity to hack into smartphones, accessing vast amounts of data, including call logs, contact lists, text messages, and geolocation information. That's according to Laura Poitras, who co-authored a report today in Der Spiegel based on NSA documents leaked by Edward Snowden. The NSA has developed specific teams to target certain companies or operating systems, such as Apple's iPhone, according to the report. The documents, some of which Der Spiegel published, show examples of private photos and text messages that the U.S. government accessed, such as an email sent by a Mexican government agency through a BlackBerry encryption technology but intercepted by the NSA. For more, we're joined by Barry Steinhardt. He's founder of Friends of Privacy USA. He joins us from Arlington, Virginia. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What are the specific kinds of information that the NSA appears to be able to access according to these documents published by Der Spiegel?
Well, it appears that they can access virtually any data that's on your smartphone, particularly if you sync the smartphone to your personal computer or to a computer, which most people do. They don't house all data exclusively on there. Smartphone, but when you think about it, I mean, our smartphones record everything from our location to our contacts, to who we email, who we text, who our friends are, who we take a photograph of. It's just really infinite the information that can be gathered.
So if the NSA does have access to this information that you're describing, you know, contacts, call logs, draft text messages, the report says that the access is to backup files established by smartphones. Are these kept on the smartphones themselves or on some remote server?
Well, it's unclear at this point. There's a lot of details that we don't have about what the NSA is capable of doing. But, you know, the important thing to remember is what the NSA is capable of doing today is primitive compared to what it will be capable of doing tomorrow. Right now, with regard to the information that's on smartphones, it appears the NSA is engaged in kind of retail surveillance. That is, it targets a particular individual, targets a particular phone, it gathers the information that's on that phone. When you think about it, though, the NSA has already engaged in wholesale surveillance of calling data on landlines by getting the providers to supply it with that information. And that's not something the NSA was capable of doing, say, 10 years ago, something they are capable of today. And they're capable of storing all that information in this massive data warehouse that they are building out west.
One of the kinds of information that you mentioned as well are images. Lots of people, of course, take video, take photographs with smartphones. And according to some of these documents made public, it did include several examples. One is a high-level government official from a foreign country that is unnamed in the report that the NSA obtained private photos taken at his home. What kind of access does this indicate?
Well, it indicates direct access to either to the smartphone and all the photographs are stored on it, or to the backup, if you will, stored remotely, probably in the cloud. But the important thing to remember here is that in theory, the NSA is limited to targeting persons outside of the United States. But that is a very, very slippery slope. We know from other documents that the NSA basically decides if there is a 50.1 chance, so slightly more than even chance, that the person is outside of the United States, that they regard that as fair game under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
And previous documents have also shown that at times when people in the U.S. are in communication with people outside the U.S., that communication also can come under the NSA surveillance.
Absolutely. Or the NSA has some reason to believe that you can be suspicious reason, but reason to believe that you're communicating with persons outside the United States. But again, remember that all they have to do to satisfy themselves is 50.1%. So basically, it's a coin toss whether or not the person is outside the United States.
Is it clear at this point what the company's roles are in this, if they're participating, if they're complying with subpoenas for information?
Well, the companies say that they are participating, but remember, the companies, if they are participating, they're prohibited by law, by threat of criminal penalties, from disclosing the participation. So we have to take with face value, at face value, it serves as that they're not participating. But if they were participating, they could tell us. The public is left guessing.
Barry Steinhardt with Friends of Privacy USA. What protections for privacy would you like to see put in place in order to balance the needs of law enforcement agencies with the call for privacy from private consumers?
Well, the protections are legal protections, not technological. The NSA will always be capable of outsmarting whatever technology is in place. We need a law that says that the NSA can only target surveillance when it has at least probable cause to believe that the individual was engaged in crime or engaged in an act of terrorism.
Barry Steinhardt is founder of Friends of Privacy USA. He joined us to discuss new information about NSA surveillance of smartphones. Thank you very much for your time.
Sure thing.
In a related update, Facebook, Google, and Yahoo filed separate court motions today to allow them to reveal more details about the government's surveillance program. The companies filed the motions in the government's secretive Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, asking the court to allow them to disclose information about the NSA's requests for information. Currently, the tech companies are barred from revealing details about the requests. In Washington, D.C. today, a federal appeals court heard a major challenge to the Federal Communications Commission's three-year-old open internet rule. The internet provider Verizon asked the court to toss out the rule entirely, saying it should have the right not only to charge websites for a better and faster service, it should be able to block some content entirely. Both the FCC and public interest groups intervening in the case warn that this would encourage corporate censorship and favoritism and stifle free speech and competition online. FSRN's Alice Olstein was in the courtroom this morning and brings us this report.
Verizon wants to strike down the FCC rule that prohibits internet providers from blocking or unreasonably discriminating against any type of internet traffic, meaning they must provide the same service without charge to powerful web giants like Google, small startup websites and blogs, and everyone in between. The only exception is if certain content interferes with their ability to maintain their broadband networks. Verizon attorney Helgi Walker told a panel of three federal judges Monday that the FCC did not have the authority to make this rule, which she called arbitrary and capricious. But both Judge David Tatel and Judge Lawrence Silberman countered that the FCC has a mandate from Congress to remove barriers to access and promote competition in telecommunications markets, and that the open internet rule could be interpreted as serving those goals. The court mainly focused on the constitutionality of two pieces of the open internet rule, a prohibition on blocking certain websites entirely, and a prohibition on service discrimination. On a noisy street outside the courthouse, Matt Wood with Group Free Press explained the difference.
Okay, it's free for everybody, but if you pay more, you get extra. I do see the distinction between that and a non-discrimination rule that says you can't charge people different amounts. You know, it's basically saying, yes, there's a guaranteed access provision. That's different from differential treatment and, you know, getting the first class package if you pay more, rather than just traveling in coach with the rest of us.
Wood said that when the FCC drafted the open internet rule, the agency heard testimony from Verizon and other broadband providers, tech companies, legal experts, and consumer advocates, and it determined that keeping a level playing field on the internet would encourage more demand for internet access, which would motivate the companies to build out their networks. After Monday's arguments, Todd O'Boyle with the consumer advocacy group Common Cause told FSRN how a ruling against the FCC could impact the evolution of the web.
What keeps Facebook or Google or whoever it might be innovating is that there are startups nipping at their heels, and a great way to prevent that from ever happening is if you partner with someone like Verizon and say, we want to make sure that customers can get to us quickly and can't get to anybody else, either by slowing or degrading all the upstarts. Therefore, the incentive to create and compete and innovate and make the internet useful is gone.
Several public interest groups joined the case as interveners, including the organization Public Knowledge, arguing for the court to uphold the open internet rule. Their president and CEO, Gigi Sohn, said companies like Verizon already charge individual users different rates, and they're now asking for permission to charge websites as well. She also questioned whether Verizon has the legal standing to argue this case.
Was Verizon actually harmed by these rules? Since Verizon has never done a double-sided market or tried to charge, you know, a toll twice for internet access, were they actually harmed? Do they have the right to even be in the courtroom? I don't think it was a frivolous argument, as Verizon's counsel argued, to make that standing argument.
The court only briefly touched on another key argument from Verizon, that it should be able to block certain websites not just if they refuse to pay more fees, but also if it disagrees with their content. Judge Silberman asked the FCC if forcing Verizon to carry a website that has, say, information about using chemical weapons against the United States violates the company's First Amendment rights. This argument was quickly dismissed by the other judges and the FCC, who agreed that Verizon isn't itself speaking when it carries a website. But Boyle says he's concerned by the company's attempt at censorship.
They wanted to exert editorial control, and they compared themselves to a newspaper. But when the FCC briefly mentioned, if you read something at thewashingtonpost.com, you don't think, oh, I can't believe what Verizon just said, because they're not a newspaper, they are a conduit. And when Verizon starts talking about wanting the right to edit the internet, we get really concerned.
The court is expected to take several months to deliberate on this case and could issue its decision in December or early next year. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Rose Katapchi. Our theme music was composed and produced by Alan Weatherhead. Teddy Wilson manages our Tumblr page, where you can find sights and sounds from FSRN's global reporters. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.